into flames. Freedom, freedom, I can't move. Freedom, cut me loose. Freedom, freedom, where are you? 'Cause I need freedom too. I break chains all by myself. Won't let my freedom ride in hell. Hey, I'ma keep on running 'cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
You know, it's just 3 or 4 years before they start playing that at football games and, you know, seventh innings at baseball stadiums and stuff like that. But right now, it's very cool. It's very bespoke. It's something that maybe you haven't heard so far. Once upon a time, Beyonce said, if you like it, you should put a ring on it. Now she's taking the ring off and tossing it to the floor of a grungy-looking parking garage. And the finger she's really interested in on Lemonade is the third finger, not the fourth. The singer's new release takes the form of a visual album. We'll explain what that is. It's both a defiant up yours to a man we assume is Jay-Z, and an assertion of herself, and by extension, the womanhood of people around her, of a claim to... Well, it goes in a lot of different directions, but it starts at least on a very angry note and heads towards reconciliation and redemption. And formation. Anyway, we'll find out what else it is from this great panel we have here. We're down in New Haven in the WNPR Audubon Street studios with Mercy Quay, a freelance journalist and an activist in New Haven and the founder of the Narrative Project. She's making her debut on the Nose today. We're so excited. Kate Rushen is a poet, and now she's like just a veteran of the Nose, poet, writer, and educator. Brian Slattery is an arts editor for the New Haven Independent and a producer at WNHH Radio. And a musician, too, which is helpful, I think, because we're going to spend really a pretty good chunk of this show talking about this unusual release by Beyonce. It's unusual in a lot of different ways, including the way in which it was released and the forms that it takes. And you may not be all that familiar with it. That's okay. We'll try to explain what it is to you. That will be our first job. And so, Mercy, maybe you can help us start this off. It isn't really just one thing. It isn't like a CD the way things used to be. It is this little 1 hour movie, and it takes a whole bunch of different forms.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting. At this point, I think Beyonce has defined what is what we understand to be an album, right? The idea of a visual album comes from Beyonce. If you want to make a visual album, you have to top Beyonce, or at least use Beyonce as your blueprint. And it is in several different forms, you know, with what she's done with Formation and dropping Formation at the time of the Super Bowl, right? Mm-hmm. Dropping it on social media and then having the beehive kind of ensue, right? What's happening? And she did the sort of same thing here with Lemonade. Teased it the week before. She teased it and HBO teased it, and you knew something was coming. You didn't know what it was about, and you certainly didn't know that it was going to be hinting at, you know, alleged infidelity or apparent infidelity. And it was beautifully done, and I think she is the standard now when it comes to visual albums.
Kate Rushen, while geeks like me were getting excited about Game of Thrones this weekend, cool people like you were going. Did you go to a Lemonade party, a kind of watch Lemonade on HBO
party?
Yeah,
I did. I got invited. It was a small party. There were four of us women, three African-American, one European descent, and it was cool. I was sitting on the edge of my seat. My mouth dropped open. I was excited. And we actually watched it on tape, so we were able to stop and talk about it, mm-hmm. and people could catch up with things that they didn't quite know what was going on visually. So it was a really great event. And I'm really glad to be here today to talk about it, because I think we're going to be talking about Lemonade for a long time to come, because I think, you know, she has set the bar really high. And I see the film, I see Lemonade in the context of black women, African-American women filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And I see how Beyonce has played off the work of Alice Walker in The Color Purple and Toni Morrison and Beloved and filmmakers, you know, who people never have heard of, who've come and gone, like Kathleen Collins and Jackie Shear, and most pointedly Julie Dash and Daughters of the Dust. So I was really excited about that.
You said this film, Daughters of the Dust, is getting kind of a revival, partly, I think, a little bit because of this. It's going to be shown at Cannes. Apparently, it needs to have its colors retuned or something. But that's a big part of this. So we've still done a pretty poor job, I think, of trying to explain what this is. I will do an attempt in layman's terms and as best I can. But so what you have is this one-hour film. It really does look like a film that you're watching. It looks a lot like a Terrence Malick film. It probably looks especially like Tree of Life, but as Brian and others will say, and as Kate just suggested, it looks like other things too. It begins with a series of rather angry and bruised and hurt songs, and then there's kind of a middle section where Beyoncé or whoever this persona is begins to think about the whole question maybe a little bit differently, and then ends with reconciliation and redemption and all this stuff. And while you're watching this, there are chunks of poetry. If you're doing the full visual album, and there are lots of different formats, there are chunks of poetry interspersed that she speaks. Turns out she's very good at speaking poetry, too, I think. She speaks these, and there's the little bird sounds and music boxes playing Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, and all kinds of things are going on as you're watching this. These often very beautiful scenes of the South. It's all in the Deep South. It's either, it looks like Sea Islands sometimes it looks like Texas, sometimes it looks like Louisiana, but it's always this incredibly rich, beautiful, mossy South. So, Brian, I know, actually, because of you, I'm more aware of the fact that although there's something very sui generis about Beyoncé and what she's doing, we're also living in an era where artists, particularly African-American artists, they drop these major projects, which you don't just listen to a couple of times. I mean, you have to spend a lot of time kind of just getting with them.
Yeah. As any good musician is, I'm also a rabid music fan. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I keep telling people over and over again these days is that it's pop music hasn't really been this exciting for a long time. There's a great way that there are a whole bunch of artists that you feel like are having a conversation with each other. You know, the ones that like came immediately to mind when we were talking about the show were, you know, there's Beyoncé and there's D'Angelo and there's Frank Ocean and there's Kendrick Lamar, and they're all kind of like, it feels like a really healthy competition. It's the like who can make the statement, who can say it in a way that makes everybody else go, you got it right. Mm-hmm. And that sort of, it's the kind of artistic one-upsmanship that just leads to like a lot of really interesting things being produced.
Yeah. So,
and it's, you know, for everybody else, it's just totally pleasurable.
And the other thing about these projects, one thing that they all share in common, all the artists that you just talked about, is they're incredibly eclectic in their musical influences.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you just
really
read,
diverse.
There's a 1,300 word list of credits to the Beyoncé album, and a lot of it because she's sampling so many different things and going out in so many different
areas.
Kendrick Lamar's "To Pimp a Butterfly" is so reliant on recognizable jazz tropes.
Right.
D'Angelo's "American Messiah" also kind of that way, and a little bit Marvin Gaye.
No, absolutely.
You know, and Frank Ocean's "Orange." All of these they're not just straight up anything. They're really, really interested in a whole bunch of different
styles. And I love the way that they have. It seems like everyone's decided that it's okay for the songs on an album to not really sound very much like each other, mm-hmm. which to me is like a wonderful thing. You know, that like I love that. I cheered when I heard like the brass band stuff on the on Lemonade, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, great. You know, we're really moving around some musical territory here, which is, you know, totally wonderful. Mm-hmm.
There's even a recipe for lemonade. You get to hear how to make it. So, Mercy, okay, now we got to go there. We've got to dive into this. So, one of the questions that's posed, and some people don't even think that it's much of a question, but so the first 25 to 30 minutes of this piece is a woman talking about the incredible pain and betrayal she feels about her man having side chicks, having stepped out on her, there's been this incredible, as you alluded to, whirlwind of stuff going on Instagram,
yeah.
all kinds of places about this. But there's a fundamental question here, right? I mean, is this a persona talking about another persona, or is this Beyoncé really kind of using almost at this Olympian level of Zeus and Hera,
sure.
You know, her actual marriage and the fact that Jay-Z is apparently turning himself into a swan and mounting, you know, various targets. I mean, what's going on here? I mean, there's a big argument going on about this, right?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't actually decided where I stand on this or, you know, I haven't figured it out for myself yet. But I think I would I respect Beyoncé so much more if it's not about her own marriage, right? Mm-hmm. That it stands for something greater, right? And I think especially coming from like the Black female perspective, what that means, right? Or even if you were thinking about it in sense of, you know, the Black community's relationship with America, mm-hmm. that's another way to think about it. And I think the figurative language here, if that's what she was going for, genius. Mm-hmm. If that's not what she was going for, and if it was a little bit more basic and she was talking about her, you know, the ills of her imperfect marriage, that's also fine.
Couldn't it be all those things anyway?
It could be. It could be all of it. And I think that's what makes Lemonade so beautiful, mm-hmm. right? You can interpret it however you want. I'll admit that I fell into the rabbit hole of gossip.
It's hard. It's impossible not to. Yeah, I think at least for, you know, everyone gets an hour at least.
Right. If everyone gets an hour, then I think I'm a little bit more guilty.
I mean, at least. So,
yeah. BuzzFeed did a piece. It was like everything you need to know about Beyoncé's Lemonade and how the album should have been called Tea because of how much gossip was actually in it. And inside of it, there was a video of Wendy Williams breaking down all the rumors over the years, the Solange Jay-Z elevator, you know, showdown, which was really more like a slaughter, mm-hmm. if you watched it, and it's hard to tell, you know, was Jay-Z cheating on her? I don't know that it matters, right? I think that alone, like outside, independent of that fact, this is a great piece, and the beauty in it lies in the fact that you can interpret it however you want.
The gossip gets particularly interesting when he himself shows up in the movie.
Right.
That was the point where you're like, all right, what's going on here? You're like, you.
But did he know?
Like, they've made an art project out of something. Right.
But yeah, but I want to know how much of the movie he'd seen before Saturday night. Dude, he may have only seen the scenes where he's in there reading Le Figaro, which I didn't quite understand. But,
well, you know, Jay's Beyoncé has welcomed this debate because she has her family in the film. Mm-hmm. Jay-Z's in the film, Blue Ivy's in the film, her parents have a cameo, mm-hmm. but still we can't forget that the spine of the narration is based on the poetry of Warshan, mm-hmm. Warshan Shire. Mm. And in particular, she has a poem called Warshan, the Seven Stages of Loneliness, mm-hmm. where she goes through a series of stages dealing with grief and loss and betrayal and love and all of that. Mm-hmm. And I think that we can't forget it's a piece of art. It's mm-hmm. art, it's poetry, it's music, and it's closer, I think, to fiction as a work of art than it is to biography. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we should let that get obscured, that she's created this incredible piece of art drawing mm-hmm. on not only the musicians and songwriters, mm-hmm. but she's really tapped into kind of an international Black intelligentsia.
Right.
You know, in her piece and pulling in writers and using ideas from photographers and from literature.
You know, it's also, of course, a piece of commerce, and there's a lot of interesting things going on with that, including the fact that there was this HBO drop. And then for a while, one of the more possible places to listen to it is this thing called Tidal, which is, in fact, owned by Mr. Jay-Z himself. So this is, but they had some exclusivity for a little while, I think, mm-hmm. which is sort of like, you know, Priscilla Chan doing her big takedown of Mark Zuckerberg and then making it available only on Facebook or something. I mean, it just seemed like an unusual arrangement. But it's been interesting to watch. These people are both very, very good business people. Mm-hmm. They're very, very smart. Mm-hmm. And they've done a really great job that way. One of the questions that I have about this, though, is just to go back to what we said at the beginning, Mercy, you know, because it is different things, I'm finding myself wondering how those things will survive over time. I mean, I've now been through the movie or whatever we want to call it a couple of times. I'm probably not going to watch that movie a lot more times, but obviously I'm going to listen to the music. So on the way down in the car, I did there's so many iterations of this on Tidal that it's actually kind of confusing. Mm-hmm. I even wound up with one that I didn't want. But anyway, I just did it as a purely audio experience. There's an edit that doesn't have any of the poetry in it. It's just song, 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 song. And I was trying to think, like, how is this going to be after everybody's all through watching all these beautiful, you know, mossy and, you know, sea sprayed and urban images and watching her all the smash all the windows in the cars and all this cool stuff? You know, how's the music going to be? And actually, I was having a lot of fun with the music, at least for now.
Right. Yeah. I got into a conversation with someone about whether the music was entertaining on its own. And I think so, right?
Definitely.
Right. I don't know that any totally agree with you. Other song has penetrated my ears in the last week, right? I don't think that I've listened to anything else. On its own, independent of the actual film, it is a great piece of art, right? But I think you do have to see the film. Mm-hmm. I think outside of just listening to the music, you know, once you have seen that film, you can kind of connect the meaning, right? Mm-hmm. And the poetry of Shire, right? Throughout every single song and sort of intertwine that into your experience. It's an experience is what it is. We were trying to pinpoint what it is at the beginning of the conversation. Yeah. It's an experience. And the entire piece is an experience.
The next one will be a ride, too. You know, right. You get in and they, you know, put the little thing on you and you ride through. Let's just, so we're not being too abstract about this. Let's hear one of the cuts from the album. This is called, we're going to hear a little chunk of Sorry.
Trying to roll me up. I'm sorry. I ain't picking up. I'm sorry. Headed to the club. I'm sorry. I ain't thinking about you. I'm sorry. Me and my lady sip my juice a cup. I don't give up chucking my deuces up. What's for my pawpaws? I had enough.
I told you about those fingers. So this is, by the way, the song that ends, I think, with the Becky with the good hair, who is probably being hunted by assassins right now. Right?
Whoever she may
be. Unfortunately, as the Beehive has already targeted several wrong people.
Yeah, poor Rachel Ray, who was just trying to run her cooking empire, and she was mistaken for a paramour. You know, Brian, one thing that I was noticing here, and this isn't an original observation with me either, but and that song wasn't maybe necessarily the best example. We'll have some other ones. But one thing that I was noticing was Beyoncé as a singer on this, and she's always had quite a bit of range and expressiveness as a singer, but here she groans, she croaks, she growls, she sings beautiful ballads in the voice that we have always known her to have. I'm finding her especially expressive as a performer on this.
Yeah, and I feel like we kind of have been seeing this coming, you know, as she figures out how to do even more with this really spectacular voice that she has. Like her last album has a lot of that too. I mean, when was that, 2013 or something? She does like...
Yeah, like Christmas, or Christmas of 2014, maybe?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I remember that being like my first takeaway from that album was like, man, she can do anything with that voice she has. And she does. And then on this one, there's even more. I mean, it's and I think that's part of what, even part of what drives all the different musical styles on the album is that it makes all of those things make sense.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, it's the kind of album you get to make when you can sing anything.
And then we have to remember that she started off in the church, right?
Yeah.
And I think that when we think about her groaning, right, and having that very, you know, epiglottal type of sound, right, I think about gospel. I think about her gospel. I don't even say humble beginnings, but her beginnings in the church and singing gospel, and then somehow along the way refining her tone. And I think now she's kind of coming back, and you know, we can speculate about why, but it's sort of refreshing to hear sort of go back to that sound.
Sure. Absolutely. And then also have those, like, those moments where she can sing as if she's already auto-tuned, which is really cool.
Yeah, I love that there's some country in there. Mm-hmm. I was talking to a professor friend of mine who's from Rutgers, who's actually at who's from Houston, and she said she really related to the this is Melanie Price, Professor Melanie Price, and she said she really related to the Southern scenes, but also the country music.
Let's actually hear a little bit of this. I think you're referring especially to the song Daddy's Lesson. So that, Kate, is a really different sound. I don't think I've ever heard her sing in that vein before.
I love it. I think it's great.
This was the moment in the movie where I was hooked. When this song, I had my sort of, you know, I had my little critical brain going through the movie until we got to this song. And then I was like, forget it. I'm just going to really enjoy this.
Although, maybe I'm alone in this, and I have a lot more listening to do before I would really sort of own this statement. But I've actually did feel as though the first half of the music was more fun, more interesting. I won't say fun because it's about pain, it's about anger. But all these really, you know, angry songs and these songs exploring really difficult emotions and maybe shifting a little bit into, well, what's wrong with you anyway? How come at one point she says, why don't you want to be in heaven? In other words, with me.
Right.
And you know, and then the reconciliation stuff, although it's some of it's very pretty and there's some of it's very anthemic. Somehow or other, I don't know, it didn't cook for me quite the same way, you know, and certainly the Sandcastle song, which is this lovely ballad, and she's got a wonderful voice, but she's it's a piano ballad, and I thought, I feel like I've heard that song before, and I didn't feel that way at other points.
Yeah, I think when Daddy's Lessons came on, I was just like, what is this? And then, you know, I had to tune in a little bit more, and I was just like, this is amazing. I'm so happy that I'm hearing this, and there's something so familiar about it to me. I mean, I come from a family I come from a Gullah family from the islands of Beaufort, South Carolina, which is as country as it sounds. And, and you know, there's something super familiar about that feel to me. And I don't want to say hee-haw, but like, you know, very honky-tonk and very just southern, right? And I can't explain how familiar it was and how great of a feeling that was. And the beginning of the album, it does feel personal. And this is sort of when I started to realize that this could be interpreted as a little bit more of the Black community's relationship with the country, right? Because it starts to take this turn at some point, and you kind of see that with Daddy's Lessons, and you start seeing that with Freedom. And I think the later half of the album, you can start seeing that progression towards a greater meaning outside of infidelity.
Well, one of the most surprising parts of the film to me were the scenes of the mothers of Trayvon Martin and Eric Gardner and others dressed for high occasion, very solemnly and silently holding pictures of their dead sons, framed pictures of their dead sons before them. That caught me totally off guard, but I think it speaks to what you're talking about.
Yeah.
That clearly Beyoncé is not, I would argue, is not only talking about her own personal experience, mm-hmm. but she is talking about experiences of many Black women, African American women, over generations, very different experiences. But she puts the Black woman at the center mm-hmm. of the story, mm-hmm. and I think that's one of the things that's so remarkable to me about the piece.
And I think a parallel that I saw there was also, you know, the film Eve's Bayou, which the entire film comes from the perspective of the Black women in the film, most specifically Eve, who is portrayed by Journey Smollett. And, you know, I drew parallels. That was filmed in Louisiana. This is apparently filmed in Louisiana. And, you know, the idea of the Black matriarch was also present there. But then the idea of going from your father's, I'll say, possession to your husband's possession. And that was a large part of the spoken word that was that you hear right before she gets into Daddy's Lessons. She says something to the effect of, am I talking about your father or your husband? Mm-hmm. And so I think we can't forget that, right? So you're right. Seeing all of this in the perspective of the Black woman is sort of pivotal to the piece.
Can I ask just one more question about that, too? Because I was, and this is a stretch of a comparison, but not entirely. I was thinking about something that had run, I think, on a Saturday on HBO, maybe 2 weeks before Lemonade, and it was Confirmation, which was about probably the Gullah speaker that Americans know best. That would be Clarence Thomas, who grew up speaking and grew up in that same environment speaking that. And I remember at the time of, not the movie, but the events themselves, and also feeling that watching the movie a little bit, that, but at the time I remember Black people saying, there's a lot about this that you don't get. You know, mm-hmm. that there's a lot of things going on here that, because in fact the white community often sees African Americans as almost this kind of monolithic, oh, you're all the Black people over there, you know, and they're saying, no, there's like all kinds of things that you're not getting about this. And I, when Formation came out, when the video of Formation came out at the time of the Super Bowl, I was watching it thinking, I bet there's a lot, I mean, I did a lot of reading and I read about Plissage and all kinds of stuff, but I thought, I bet you there's a lot of stuff I'm not getting, you know, I mean, yeah.
I think you're right about Formation. The idea that wearing your hair natural as a Black woman is a political statement, it's not, right? It's sort of a liberating feeling and has almost nothing to do with the effect that you want to sort of cause on other people or, you know, what you want to draw out of other people. That was one thing that we see out of Formation. And then the tribute to Malcolm X or the perceived tribute to Malcolm X. I don't know if Beyonce has actually ever spoken on it or not. In the Black Panther movement, you know, with the black berets and the leather outfits, I thought it was awesome. But I think that, people... take issue with it, right? Mm. But I also think that this lends itself to what you're talking a bit about, the idea that the Black community sees things with a Black lens, right? Mm. And even though you something might be written in white ink, the Black community sees it with the Black lens and is able to sort of navigate through that space and translate it with their experience.
That brings to mind another scene that really struck me, and it was a so-called Mardi Gras Indian, all in white.
Oh, Chapatula.
In a dining room, mm-hmm. and with a tambourine and moving in a very ritualistic way. And then later on, I was shocked to find out that this Mardi Gras figure was one of the mothers who had lost a son. And she was holding his picture and looking at his picture. And I said, whoa, this is a different take on Mardi Gras than most of us outsiders or drunken tourists have.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that I wondered about was whether we would have four times as many conversations as the ones we've had this week about Lemonade had Prince not died. It feels as though in some ways, you know, Prince in many respects, in some of the ways that you were talking about before, Brian, she's following Prince in that mixing of styles and in mixing of vocal styles. I mean, nobody had more vocal styles ever than Prince. But, you know, it is sort of an odd thing. Like, here's this, I think, pretty epic, you know, game-changing release by this, you know, by one of the foremost performers in America right now, if not kind of the queen of everything. But in a way, it's like everybody was still gulping down, you know, their sorrow and calling up, you know, playlists and going through all that stuff.
Yeah, that's there's probably something to that. Though I also sort of feel like Prince has been like one of the guiding spirits of a lot of stuff that we hear in pop music now.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's not just that he died. I think it's that he's turned out to have such an enormous impact with that, like that incredible mixture of like spirituality and sexuality that he has going.
And we're reminded.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's incredible today, ground. You know, like it's just so fertile. And it's, you know, what's, you know, for Prince fans, it's a pleasure to see that has turned out to be generative for other artists rather than just something where we all stand back and go, well, that's your thing and you do it amazingly and we're going to go do this other thing.
We have to take a break here. But yeah, if you're still grieving for Prince, we understand. But it's also it's time to start listening to Lemonade if you haven't done that yet. It'll make you feel better, too. It'll make you feel better about the whole world. So we're going to go out with, what are we going out with here? I can't hear you yet. We're going out with it. Okay, so we'll come back with more of our conversation after this. They're sneaking out the back door. He only wants me when I'm not there. He better call Becky with the good hair. He better call Becky with the good hair. In our bit, we don't have the thank yous. Okay. So I'll do the thank yous. Thanks to, you're pointing somewhere else. Oh, that's right. We had such a long first segment that I've actually gotten lost in the format of the show. Okay, so we're here in New Haven. I'm disoriented anyway because we're here in the New Haven studios. And also, we talked for a really long time about Beyonce, but we just had to. And we actually all have more things to say. So I don't know what we'll do exactly about that, but we'll put out a web extra. We'll write little essays or something. With us is Mercy Quay. She is making her first appearance here on The Nose. She's a freelance journalist and an activist in New Haven, the founder of the Narrative Project. Kate Rushen, poet, writer, educator. With us, Brian Slattery, arts editor of the New Haven Independent and the producer and a producer at WNHH Radio. So I have to shift gears a little bit. Because we're in New Haven, we couldn't pass up this story. So people are always talking about how politicians are out of touch with normal America, or, you know, the normal people in America or normal places in America. So one of the many quants at 538, which is Nate Silver's website, his name is Jed Kolko, decided to figure out, well, what is normal America? Where is normal America? Who's normal in America? And so he writes, I calculated how demographically similar each U.S. metropolitan area is to the U.S. overall, based on age, educational attainment, and race and ethnicity. And then he indexed them all. And it turns out that by that measure, or those measures, the metropolitan area that looks most like the U.S. is New Haven, Connecticut, followed by Tampa, Florida, and then Hartford, Connecticut. So all of the 10 large metro areas that are demographically most similar to the U.S. overall are in the Northeast, Midwest, or center of the country, with the exception of Tampa. So I'm not really quite sure what to make of this information, and it's probably not dispositive. I mean, first of all, Mercy, does it feel good to be normal, or would you rather not be normal?
I work really hard to be normal, and it feels good to finally be recognized. I have all of 800 followers on Twitter, and I'm happy that, you know, they recognize me or can now see me as a normal person. And I've always thought of myself as normal. I'm just happy that you guys are now in that number as well.
Well, yeah, it's nice. Thanks for counting us in. By the way, you can follow her at Mercy _ right now. She can have another 800 followers. There you go. I think there's sort of a more profound statement here, too, which is that there's this trope that is invoked all the time. So-and-so is out of touch with normal America, whoever it is. And it's a way of suggesting, oh, well, there's this place, and it's out in the Midwest, and it, you know, looks a little bit, has porches like the ones in Lemonade, and it's, you know, people are normal there, and whatever. Yeah. And then whatever set of projections the commentator wants to do onto that statement happen. But I don't think ever, when that trope is invoked, anybody's thinking about a Northeastern city with a big college in it and a whole bunch of funky coffee shops.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I mean, when I read the article, like, I just could not stifle my sense of, like, smugness. In, you know, mostly because...
Were you at Starbucks?
No, coffee with a K. Come on, man.
It was mostly that, being a journalist here, I've been like constantly surprised at how much like what happens in this small city seems to resonate with other places. Mm-hmm. Like when I go other places, I feel like I understand them better because I understand where I live better. And, you know, that sort of, you know, vague, totally subjective thing. It's nice to see that like that there may actually be something there and it's not just me like hopefully projecting.
Yeah.
You know, my sense of what I think I understand.
Kate, give me your reaction.
You know, when I hear terms like normal America, I think that people are conjuring up images that we've gotten from old movies mm-hmm. and TV shows. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I won't go all the way back to Ozzie and Harriet, but I say Ozzie and Harriet all the way up to... I don't know, Seinfeld. And I live east of the river, and I see a lot of people struggling, working really hard, going through a lot of issues and pain, you know, with, you know, this whole drug thing is going on now. And,
yeah.
You know, we just had information come out about suicide rate
yeah.
and mortality rates. Among white people. And I think, you know, there's something racialized behind this term normal America. And I think mm-hmm. that term obscures a lot of pain that a lot of people across the board are going through and a lot of struggles that people are having.
Yeah. And I like to, in a lot of ways, replace normal for typical, right? I think that, for instance, right, this past summer, my boyfriend and I, who's from Cody, Wyoming, we did a road trip. And if I was going by, you know, the sociological definition of normal, I was not normal when I was driving through North Dakota or South Dakota or Montana or Wyoming. But I was thinking the same thing, but with this, you know, thinking the same thing of the people that I was afraid to walk into gas stations with, right? Wow, this is just not normal. And you're right that there is something racialized about that. And I think if we can sort of divorce that idea and we can sort of start seeing that New Haven is really the standard and we can all start being more like New Haven.
I mean, I think New Haven is the beneficiary, if that's the right word, of a kind of a statistical quirk. I was thinking about this a little bit more.
Yeah.
And being the political geek that I am, I was thinking about election primary results. Mm. So what happened in the Connecticut primaries was that Hillary Clinton won two kinds of areas. One of them was very wealthy areas, places like Greenwich and stuff like that. And she won by overwhelming margins. Right. She didn't win very many towns, but when she won big. And then she also won really big in the cities. And she would win once again by overwhelming margins, huge margins in places like Bridgeport and Hartford, sometimes almost doubling the number that Bernie Sanders had. And New Haven was kind of anomalous. She won, but it was, first of all, it was the biggest voter turnout of anywhere in Connecticut, 16,000 votes in that Democratic primary. She got about 9, he got about 7. And you didn't see that anywhere else, that kind of closeness. So what are you seeing? Well, you're seeing she does well, according to one of the urban data guy. She does well with middle-class blacks in particular. So you've got a city like New Haven that has a black population, a middle-class black population. She's going to do really well there. But it's also got this student population, mm-hmm. You know, a pretty white student population that's going to go for Bernie. So in some ways, the number, you know, I mean, I think, first of all, it's great that people understand that these northeastern cities often do have compositions that more closely track the real look of and feel of America. But probably New Haven benefited from this weird little thing, you know? I mean, it would be an urban city where Hillary Clinton doubled Bernie Sanders' vote, except mm-hmm. there's this kind of anomalous population that's sitting, you know, a rock's throw away from here. It's Yale, right?
And Quinnipiac, since I'm
in Quinnipiac. Yeah. Didn't mean to diss Quinnipiac. all right. So we're going to take a little break here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about, since it's, I hope we do some recommendations about how to enjoy this incredibly normal city here, but recommendations about all kinds of things when we come back.
Haven, Connecticut. What a great, great city. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, New Haven, a fine, fine place. They got the Ivy League college, they do. It's Yale University, lots of smart people. They learn a lot of stuff and they get...
Today's Extremely Normal show is produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Kanye West. For show pages, articles, and a one-hour video of the Here and Now staff making lemonade, go to our website, wnpr.org/Colin. On Monday's show, we look at the Connecticut backstory and the international ties of Donald Trump's most important advisor. And now, back to Colin.
That's right. Donald Trump, in his quest, has recruited a guy who's a supreme and superlative political insider. He's a guy who comes from a three-generation construction family in Connecticut. He's from that second generation, but he became a national and then international political operative with some pretty interesting stories that go along with that. So that's one of the stories we'll be telling you on Monday on the Monday Scramble. Right now, we're here in the New Haven studios on Audubon Street in incredibly normal New Haven. Mercy Quay is with us. She's a freelance journalist and an activist in New Haven and the founder of The Narrative Project. Kate Rushen is a poet, writer, and educator. Brian Slattery is the arts editor for the New Haven Independent. And I should say, a musician with a band, somebody who will probably be writing a better New Haven song than the one that played us at. What's the name of your band again?
Oh, my God. It has a ridiculously long name.
No, you can say it.
Okay. If we have 5 minutes. Yeah. The Dr. Catterwall's Cadre of Clairvoyant Claptraps.
All right.
Oh, yeah. So, I've heard of you.
Yeah. So,
wow.
So hey. they will be coming up with a sort of Balkan-sounding New Haven song. all right. So we're going to make some recommendations here. So, Brian, since you have the floor right now, make some recommendations.
Especially since we're here in New Haven, the recommendation I feel like I should make is that everyone should listen to this album called Broken Bone Ballads, which is by a hip-hop artist named Chesky, which is spelled C-E-S-C-H-Y-C-H-I. And Broken Bone Ballads has the distinction of being the album that got me to stop listening incessantly to Black Messiah and listen to something else. It came out about 2 months afterward, and I thought maybe that would be the album I'll listen to all year. And then Broken Bone Ballads came out, and I started listening to that incessantly. And he's from here in New Haven, and he's one of those people who tours constantly. So he's not here very much. But this album is a real sort of encapsulation of what the guy is about. And it's like a lot of things I've been talking about, I like, it's really multi-genre. You know, it's sort of grounded in hip hop, but it pulls in, you know, everything from, your sort of like almost folkish thing to some more punk stuff to even, there's a song that sounds vaguely like a Burt Bacharach.
Well, he's from New Haven, so he's a regular guy.
Yeah, he's a regular guy.
So is it available on Tidal? Because they have a subscription to Tidal.
Let's see, where would you get it? I mean, it's definitely, if you Google him, his Bandcamp page will show up. And he also runs a record label that he's... Okay.
See the title one more time?
Broken Bone Ballads.
All right, so type that into Tidal and see if you get it. You'll get it somewhere. Kate Rushen, what have you got for us?
All right, I like to endorse The Big Read. I'm involved with it this year. It's a program of the National Endowment of the Art in conjunction with libraries all over the country to encourage us to read. And the Hartford Big Read selection this year is Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck, one of the most acclaimed novels of the 20th century, and inspiring to many artists, including Bruce Springsteen and Rage Against the Machine and many others. And I'm going to be leading a discussion at the main branch of the Hartford Public Library this coming Thursday, May 12th. That's 500 Main Street. And, you know, it's a big read. It's like a 455-page book. But it is on CD, and there is a 100-page English language learner edition. And the movie is great. The movie, 1939 John Ford movie, starring Henry Ford. So I'd recommend that. And for my New Haven connection, I've got a shout out to the New Haven International Festival of Arts and Ideas, which is coming up in June. And people can get more information by going to artidea.org. And George Clinton will be on the New Haven Green for free to kick it off.
Well, that should be good. All right. So, and actually also, I think there's a version of George Clinton reading The Grapes of Wrath that you can get on Tidal. It all kind of ties together. So what have you got for us, Mercy?
So I have New Haven endorsements and then some TV endorsements. So the Rock to Rock ride that's happening tomorrow to celebrate Earth Day, that's starting at Common Ground High School, and bring your bike and be a part of a great cause to ride from West Rock to East Rock. And then also there's the Hearts of Strangers community event that's happening tomorrow night. So Rock to Rock is at 9 a.m. and the Hearts of Strangers community event is happening at 7 p.m. I'm pretty sure they're going to be normal strangers, so keep that in mind. And then also for my TV endorsements, if you haven't seen Underground, please, please, please check it out. It is a great TV show starring Journey Smollett and produced by John Legend. And it's just an amazing story of slaves in the South trying to make it to freedom. It's the first ever TV show about slavery.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I'll do some New Haven endorsements, too. Tomorrow, if you can fit it into Rock to Rock, you can come down here and go to the incredible Farmer's Market at Worcester Square. It's actually right opposite that park over there. And they're open for outdoor summertime stuff already, and they've got great stuff. I was there last weekend. And then, of course, you can go over to the Yale Art Gallery, which is fabulous. Go to the Dura Europas area, which has – it's really interesting. They've kind of recreated this city from maybe about 200 A.D., something like that. They have as much of it as you can get there. It was an incredible crossroads in the Roman Empire. It has Roman stuff, Jewish stuff, worshippers of Mithra, all kinds of stuff. And it's some of it's stuff that you're actually hearing about on the news these days. There's a Palmyran section to it and everything. And then you're going to have lunch, and it's going to be actually you're going to go to Barracuda on Chapel Street, which is, I think, a Colombian restaurant.
Yeah.
And I really like Barracuda, and they have live music usually for in fact, Dave Jardina, the Brazilian guitarist, was there with a fiddle player last Saturday. So they have just live music at lunchtime. They're really nice people who run it. It's also one of the less expensive lunches in downtown New Haven. It's Colombian food, but it's like sort of, you know, breakfast wraps and breakfast burritos and stuff like that. But then they bring out arepas, I think they're called.
Arepas. Kind of
arepas, yeah. Corn cakes and yucca fries and stuff like that. And it's just, the place has got a good feel to it. All right, we have to go, right? We're done? Yeah, more or less. So thanks very much to all of you who came here today. And I hope we can get back down here to New Haven. We've got some great nose panelists down here in New Haven. And Kate and I, we don't mind driving down. So thanks to Jonathan McPants for getting the studio open for us and for putting out together this really great show. Go listen to Lemonade this weekend. We're all endorsing Lemonade, so yeah. I mean, both the drink and the music.
Like a Cracker Barrel. Yeah, we all be laughing, talking, joking, talking about this and talking about that, and talk about everything as a matter of fact. Oh yeah, talk about Torrington, Vernon, Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain. Vernon, I already said that one. Avon, Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah. Along the red.